For me to welcome you to the ninth in the Darwin seminar series. The series will shortly be a year old. As some of you may know, we were expecting to hear from Bob Trivers this afternoon. He has unavoidably been unable to come, but we have been extremely fortunate in that Dr. Austin Burt has agreed at very short notice to give us a paper. So without more ado, let me introduce him, and he's going to talk to us about genes in conflict.
Thank you very much for the introduction. Today I would like to talk to you about selfish genes and intergenomic conflict. By selfish genes, I mean genes that enhance their transmission to the next generation in ways which are detrimental to other genes within the same organism. Conventional genes enhance their transmission to the next generation by increasing the survival or reproductive success of the organism in which they are found. And all genes within that organism benefit from this. However, there's a substantial minority of genes in which, or a substantial minority of genes which are harmful to the organism in which they reside, but they are still selected for because they show some form of non-Mendelian inheritance. Because they are harmful to the organism, there are selection of other loci within that organism to suppress the action of these selfish genes, and so there are conflicts of interest between genes within the same organism. Recently, there has been increasing interest in the evolution of selfish genes and intergenomic conflict, I think in large part because the increasing numbers of examples we have of such elements. They can no longer be dismissed as weird idiosyncratic exceptions, but instead must be accepted as integral and fundamental parts of biology. So one thing I want to do today is to emphasize to you, give you a taste of the extraordinary diversity of selfish genes and the strategies that they use to perpetuate themselves. Most selfish genes, one way or another, manage to get into more than their fair share of gametes. So, whereas a conventional gene in a diploid organism, there's two alleles, and each allele gets into 50% of the gametes, these genes manage to get into 60% of the gametes, or 90% of the gametes. And that means that the other allele is left with 40% or 10%. The strategies that have evolved for getting into more than 50% of the gametes can be categorized into four groups, and I will go through each of these four groups for you and give examples of each. It is also possible for selfish genes to act by biasing the behavior of the organism towards relatives, and I will discuss that under the topic of genomic imprinting. And finally, today I want to discuss the role of the breeding system, in particular whether the species is outcrossed or inbred in the evolution and ecology of selfish genes. So to begin with the classic case of a selfish genetic element, the T haplotype in mice. This is a region on the 17th chromosome of mice. 10 to 15% of 17th chromosomes in mice carry the T haplotype. And in this haplotype has the property that when it's heterozygous in males, you've got a heterozygous male, that makes two types of sperm, T haplotype bearing sperm and wild type sperm. And it has the property that somehow the T haplotype incapacitates the wild type bearing sperm, which means that in the race to fertilize an egg, the T-bearing sperm get 95% or so of the fertilizations. And there are other examples of this. Segregation distorter in Drosophila is a gene complex which kills wild-type bearing sperm. There's gamete eliminator in tomatoes, which acts by killing wild-type bearing ovules and pollen. Something called pollen killer in wheat, which, given the name, obviously kills wild-type bearing pollen. There are killers on X chromosomes that in Drosophila that kill Y-bearing sperm, and killers loci on Y chromosomes in mosquitoes that kill X-bearing sperm. So this then is, and another example here down is spore killers in Ascomycete fungi. Ascomycete fungi are haploid, and they make hyphae. The hyphae fuse and mate. There's a brief diploid and dikaryotic phase, followed by meiosis and then a mitosis. So there are, in a sense, eight products of meiosis. And if you cross a killer strain by a non-killer strain, the four meiotic products that inherit the spore killer allele are all viable, and the other four that inherit the wild-type allele are all dead, non-functional. So this then is a strategy of spite, genes that get ahead by killing the competition. I've chosen these two examples to illustrate to you because they differ in an important way in which killers can differ, and that is in their effect in the homozygous state. So, for example, the T haplotype, when it is homozygous, causes sterility or lethality of the mouse. That means that even though it shows drive, it shows a biased inheritance, getting into 95% of the gametes through males, that means it will increase in frequency when it is rare. But because it is homozygous, sterile, or lethal, that means it cannot go to fixation, and instead will go to some intermediate equilibrium frequency. And we can contrast that with the case of the spore killer in the fungus, in which, as far as we can tell, this is homozygous normal, and so there is nothing stopping it from going to fixation. Of course, when it does go to fixation, that has two effects. First of all, once every organism in the population carries the killer allele, then you no longer see killing in the population. Everybody's got the killer allele and is resistant to it. And also, so you no longer see killing, and also selection for killing also disappears because everybody's fixed for it. And so you, over time, will expect the killing action of the killer allele to degenerate under mutation pressure because it will no longer be selected for. Once the killing function has been lost, then the resistance to killing can also degenerate under mutation pressure and will be lost from the population. So in the cases like that are homozygous normal, like spore killer, it may arise, then it might be a new mutation that arises, sweeps through the population, and then slowly degenerates over time just because there's no more selection maintaining it. And we can contrast that with the case in the T haplotype, which, because it doesn't go to fixation and remains at some intermediate equilibrium frequency, there is constantly killing shown in the population, and constantly selection for killing. And so that's a more stable situation. And as far as we can tell, our best estimate for the T haplotype in mice is that it has persisted for the last, it's been there in mice for 3 million years. And there has been sufficient, that's long enough to allow for a substantial coevolution between the T haplotype and the rest of the mouse genome. And indeed, there's been time for the evolution of multiple inversions on the T haplotype and multiple enhancers of killing. So we can see there can be a trade-off then between short-term success of a killer allele in going to fixation, but that can have that may in the long term lead to degeneration. So there's a trade-off there between short-term and long-term persistence. These examples I've given you are killers that worked very shortly after meiosis. There are other examples that are known. Lawrence Hurst at Cambridge has recently drawn attention to a nice example in mice where it seems there's the SCAT gene in mice that works in heterozygous female mice to kill progeny that do not inherit that gene. So if a heterozygous female, half her progeny are expected to inherit the gene and half not. It would seem that if this gene kills the progeny that don't inherit that gene, and so that allows more resources for the ones that do inherit the gene. And there are also genes that in plants work in the styles of plants to kill pollen that do not carry that particular gene. So killing can happen at multiple stages of the multiple stages in the life cycle. That is the first strategy that I want to tell you about for getting into more than your fair share of gametes. The second one is directed movement towards the germline, what you might call gonotaxis. And again, several elements show this, but certainly the masters of this are the B chromosomes. Now, B chromosomes are extra or supernumerary chromosomes found in some individuals of a population and not in others. So the fact that they're in some and not some individuals and not in others means they're not essential to the development of the organism. And indeed, in most well-studied cases, the B chromosomes turn out to be deleterious to the organism. And they persist in populations only because they are inherited in a more than Mendelian rate. And they do this, there's a common theme in the way in which they manage to get inherited in a more than Mendelian rate, and that is that they show directed movement towards the germline. And that can happen at three different stages in the life cycle of the organism. I should mention B chromosomes are, again, not a weird idiosyncratic thing. They're reported from about 15% of plant species and are also known in hundreds of animal species. So one place where it can do it is at female meiosis. For example, in this grasshopper, during female meiosis, during the first myeloid division, where in female animals, only one of the four meiotic products is viable, that's the egg, and the other four are degenerate polar bodies. In this grasshopper, at the first meiotic division, the spindle pole is asymmetrical. So the spindle is larger on the side that is eventually going to contribute towards the egg, and smaller on the side that is going to contribute to the polar body. This is where all the chromosomes are lined up here, the metaphase plate. And so you can see, because of this asymmetry, that a B chromosome which just randomly positions itself within this spindle apparatus is going to be more often than not going to be on the side that is the egg, that is going to go towards the egg and away from the side that's going to be the polar body. And so in this particular grasshopper, a single B chromosome is inherited 80% through females rather than the expected Mendelian 50%. Another example, another point at the life cycle where this can happen is pre-meiotically, before meiosis, during the mitotic divisions. For example, in a plant, a composite, if you start a zygote with just a single B chromosome, you would normally expect all the cells within that plant to contain a B chromosome faithfully replicated through mitosis. But in actual fact, you find that the B chromosome is unstable and shows non-disjunction. So that means the DNA the chromosome is replicated when all the other chromosomes get replicated. But instead of going one chromosome to each side at mitosis, they stick together and they both go to the same pole. Not only do they show that, but the way in which those two go is directed. So if you've got a cell that's got one B chromosome, it can go through a mitosis to make a cell containing zero Bs and two B chromosomes. And it's directed in the sense that the two B chromosomes that are stuck together will preferentially go towards cells that are going to contribute to the germline and away from cells that are going to contribute to somatic lines, such as leaves or roots or petals. And so you get accumulation then of B chromosomes in the germline. Finally, you can also get this happening after meiosis, particularly in grasses. In plants, of course, there are mitotic divisions after meiosis. And in the pollen, for example, here's one of your haploid meiotic products. It goes through two mitotic divisions normally. The first mitotic division is between, creates a tube nucleus and a generative nucleus. And at that division, the B chromosomes in many grasses show directed non-disjunction, preferentially going to the generative nucleus and away from the tube nucleus. The tube nucleus is the nucleus that helps form the pollen tube, and the generative nucleus goes through another mitotic division to form two sperm cells, one of which will fuse to form the zygote and the other fusing to form the endosperm. So you can see a commonality then in these B chromosomes is they're always going towards the germline, the tissue that has some potential for posterity, and away from somatic lines, which are a dead end. this sort of strategy then presupposes a distinction between germline and soma. And so, for example, we do not expect to see B chromosomes acting that can persist in this way in organisms that don't have this sort of a distinction between a germ and soma, like probably single-celled organisms like yeast and Chlamydomonas. And even within filamentous fungi, there's little opportunity for B chromosomes. So some strategies will work with some organisms, but not with other organisms. Third strategy I would like to talk to you about is one of the most obvious ones, perhaps, and that's over-replication. So instead of, whereas while everybody else is replicating once during a cell cycle, these genes manage to replicate twice in a cell cycle, and so increase in copy number in that way. This is perhaps my favorite selfish gene because it's just so simple. This is the homing endonucleases. For example, the VDE homing endonuclease gene of yeast. If you consider a heterozygous diploid organism where one chromosome has the gene and one chromosome does not have the gene, that gene is transcribed into RNA, which translated into a protein. That protein is an endonuclease, meaning that it's a protein that cuts DNA. That protein goes back into the nucleus, and it's an endonuclease that is sequence specific. So it recognizes a 20 or 25 base pair recognition sequence and then cuts that DNA. And the sequence that it recognizes is the sequence of a chromosome that does not contain the gene. So there are, they specifically recognize chromosomes that do not contain the gene. Chromosomes that do contain the gene, the presence of the gene interrupts the recognition sequence for the protein, and so they're not cut. So after digester, then after the cutting, you've got a cut chromosome and an uncut chromosome. And now the cell has a broken chromosome, and that turns on the cell's broken chromosome repair system. Now, when a cell has a broken chromosome, it just doesn't want to attach the two broken ends back together again because something important might be missing in the middle. So what it does instead is use a homologous chromosome as a template for repair, for lining up the two ends, the two broken ends, and then copying whatever might be missing in the middle. And so that's what happens. And in this case, the chromosome containing the gene is used as a template to line up the broken chromosomes and whatever in the middle, in this case, the homing endonuclease gene, is copied over to the broken chromosome. And so after repair, you've got both chromosomes containing the homing endonuclease gene. And in that way, it can be this gene is transmitted to 90% of progeny rather than the expected Mendelian 50%. This gene and others like it is like the spore killers in the fungi, is homozygous normal. And so the polymorphism that we see now in yeast populations is presumably transient, and this thing is on its way to fixation. And like the spore killers, once it's at fixation, you may then expect it to degenerate over time, unless, of course, it's able to disperse either to a new location in the genome or to a new species. Another interesting aspect of these elements is the fact that this particular one, anyway, works only at meiosis, when the cell is going through meiosis. We also know about yeast that meiotic recombination crossing over is initiated by double-strand breaks, and that yeast has a very long map length. There's a lot of crossing over happening in yeast compared to other organisms, and it is an interesting thought, anyway, just how much of that recombination that we see in yeast is just a byproduct of homing endonucleases cutting chromosomes just so that it can be transmitted over to the homologous chromosome. That's one example of an over-replicator. The transposable elements are another example of so-called jumping genes. And I'll give you one example of that, the P element of Drosophila, for example, also works by taking advantage of the cell's broken chromosome repair system. So, but in a slightly different way. If you start with an organism that's heterozygous, it's got a P element on one of its chromosomes and not on the other. This one waits till after replication of the normal replication of the chromosome. So now you've got your two chromatids, but before cell division. So you've got your two chromatids that contain the P element and two chromatids that don't contain it. Then transposition happens, and so one of these elements is cut out and goes and integrates somewhere else into the genome. And then, of course, you're left with a gap. And that gap turns on the cell's broken chromosome repair system, except in this case, it preferentially uses the sister chromatid, this one that contains the gene, as a template for repair. And so after repair, there's a P element that has been reconstituted on the place where it had jumped out of, and you've got another one integrated somewhere else in the genome. In that way, the copy number, the total number of transposable elements in the genome has been increased. And there are other types of transposable elements, too, that work in slightly different ways. The activator element of corn, for example, increases in copy number by preferentially jumping from replicated DNA to unreplicated DNA. So it works during while the cell is replicating its DNA, and it's so the replication fork moves through a particular element, moves through it twice in a single cell cycle, and so that will increase its copy number. And there are retrotransposable elements which don't actually jump anywhere, but they get transcribed into RNA. The RNA goes to the cytoplasm, and then it codes for a protein, which among other things is a reverse transcriptase, which copies the RNA back into DNA, and then that DNA is reinserted into the genome. So those are all different ways of getting more than one replication in per cell cycle. This P element is also interesting because it brings up the issue of germline versus soma again. The P element in Drosophila only does this in the germline, in germ cells, and in somatic cells, like in the wings or bristles or whatever, it's completely stable. And of course that makes sense. Transposable elements can be harmful in the sense that a new insertion might interrupt a gene, and they can cause chromosomal rearrangements, all these chromosome breaks, and cell death. So there's no point doing that in somatic cells, no point increasing the copy number in somatic cells, because that's a dead end anyway. And so the P element has apparently evolved only to transpose in the germline. The fourth way of getting into more than your fair share of gametes, I will just approximately call the sex changer strategy. Again, there are a variety of elements that have adopted this. And the logic here is that some elements are better transmitted through one sex than the other. And so they change the individual into that sex. So some elements are better transmitted through males than through females, and so they change the organism into a male, so it benefits from that increased transmission. And other elements are better transmitted through females than through males, and so they'll change the organism into a female. I will give two examples of this. First of all, the X star chromosome in lemmings. Lemmings, rodent, there's two kinds of X chromosomes in this species, just normal X chromosomes, and these X star chromosomes, which have a dominant feminizing gene on them. And so normally, of course, in mammals, if you've got a Y chromosome, you're a male. But in this case, if you're an X star Y individual, then even despite the fact that you've got a Y chromosome, you still turn into a female. So it's a dominant feminizer. What effect does that have? Well, if you're an X star Y female, you will make two kinds of eggs, X star eggs and Y eggs, and they will be fertilized by two kinds of sperm. Males are XY, so there's X sperm and Y sperm, X sperm and Y sperm. So there's four different genotypes produced by this among the progeny of this female. The YY progeny don't have any X chromosome at all, and so they are very early embryonic lethals. They die. Now, lemmings, like I believe most rodents, fertilize many more eggs at a particular time than they hope to give birth to in their litter, and there's some natural abortion along the way. Well, in these X-star Y females, it's predominantly these YY ones that suffer that abortion. And so the fact that these are lethal, the YY, that a quarter of their progeny are lethal, doesn't have any final impact on their litter size. And these females have the same, have an equivalent litter size to normal XX females. But the difference is now that this X star is present in 2/3 of those progeny rather than the normal 1/2. And so in that way, it can increase in frequency. And in, it also biases the sex ratio because you get more female, more than 50-50, more than 50% of the individuals are females. This, of course, selects for suppression of the X star activity. And one possible bit of evidence that there has been selection for suppression is the fact that in Acodon, in another group of rodents that also have XY females, the male determining gene on the Y chromosome has been duplicated. So there are 2, 3, or 5 different copies of the male determining gene on the Y chromosome of these species. And so that might be an attempt by the Y chromosome, which is suffering the most here, because it's being suffering most of the lethality. It might be an indication of attempt by the Y chromosome to remasculinize these XY females. The presence of sex ratio distortion like this doesn't only select for its suppression by the, in this case, the Y chromosome, or you can also consider it by the autosomes. It also selects, because it biases the sex ratio, it also selects for the opposite kind of sex ratio drive. So this is a sort of X drive, and it biases the sex ratio towards females. That selects, A, for its suppression, but also for Y chromosome drive, because males are now the rare sex. And so indeed, in the lemmings, in the males, there is Y chromosome drive. And that's probably a general expectation that where you see sex ratio distortion in one direction, you expect to see the evolution of sex ratio distorters that go in the opposite direction as well. And so sex ratio distorters should tend to co-occur. And that has certainly happened in the case of a parasitoid wasp in Nasonia, where the presence of some sex ratio distorters, there are multiple sex ratio distorters, and the presence of some of them are necessary for the persistence of other ones. Okay, the other example of genes with a sex-changing strategy are those that cause cytoplasmic male sterility. This is a very common phenomenon in plants. Essentially what's happening here are there are mitochondrial genes which code for male sterility, code for pollen abortion. And so what would normally be a hermaphroditic plant is now a female plant. It doesn't make any functional pollen. This is a very common phenomenon in plants. There are male sterile individuals described from 350 species of plants in 39 families. So it's a widespread phenomenon. Most of the times that this has been looked at, where they've done the inheritance, there is a cytoplasmic component to it. Well, and that kind of makes sense. Mitochondria aren't inherited through pollen anyway, and they only get inherited through ovules, through the female side. And so for a mitochondrial gene to cause pollen abortion, it does not suffer any cost from that. And if there is any benefit in doing that, if there's any compensation, that increases the ovule fitness, then that will be selected for, because mitochondrial genes, that's all they care for, is fitness through female function. And such benefits, such compensation might occur either from resources being translocated from pollen function to ovule, or from the avoidance of self-fertilization and inbreeding depression. Okay. Male sterility is sometimes found as a polymorphism within some populations. The other time it is often seen is in hybrids between species. And the probable reason for this is something as follows. If you've got a cytoplasmic male sterile gene, a mitochondrial pollen abortion gene arising and increasing in frequency in the population, that will select very strongly on nuclear genes to restore male fertility. Now, of course, nuclear genes are inherited equally through ovules and pollen, and so any gene that restores pollen fertility will be strongly selected for. And so you might get the successive evolution of a site, a mitochondrial male sterile gene followed by a nuclear restorer, and if both of those sweep through the population, you would be back at the original position of a totally hermaphroditic population. And you would only see the male sterility arising if you do crosses with populations where this hasn't happened. And indeed, you often see male sterility in hybrids between populations within a species or between species within genera or between genera within families. And you can see that in most of the cases where they've looked at the inheritance is cytoplasmic and not nuclear. That's not because pollen development is somehow particularly sensitive to mitochondrial mutations, because if you look at the induced mutations, you find what you would expect. There are many more nuclear genes involved that can mutate to male sterility than cytoplasmic genes. Cytoplasmic male sterility has often been suggested as a spur or an impetus to the evolution of separate sexes in plants, and you can see how it is one step along the way. You make some of the individuals male sterile, or i.e. females, and if the other individuals all evolve to be female sterile or male, then you're at the situation of having separate sexes, separate male and female plants. And that seems very reasonable to me that this might be an impetus to the evolution of separate sexes. But it's also true, I think, that similar mitochondrial mutants may limit the success of separate sexes. So if you've got a dioecious plant, a female that has seeds on it, and some of those seeds are going to grow up into males and some of those seeds are going to grow up into females, you can easily imagine a mitochondrial mutant that would commit suicide if it finds itself in a male plant, in a male seed, which would free up resources for the sisters. And that sort of mutation might also sweep through the population and drive it extinct. And so while cytoplasmic male sterility might be very important as an impetus to the evolution of separate sexes in plants, it's also analogous things are likely also to be an important constraint on how long such a separate sexes can persist. And perhaps that explains why diaceae is so patchily distributed within plants and apparently short-lived. So those are four different ways then that selfish genes have evolved to get into more than their fair share of gametes. And as I say, most selfish genes act in that sort of way. There is another type of selfish gene which biases the way the organism in which it is in, biases the way it acts towards its relatives. And that's because degrees of relatedness are different for different parts of the genome. Most of this work has been done with mammals, so we'll take the typical mammal family scene. Here we have mother and three offspring. These offspring, we will take the extreme situation of each one of them having a different father. And so these offspring have, at each particular locus, there's a maternal and a paternal locus. And the maternal one, of course, comes from mother and has a probability of one half of also being in each of these siblings. The paternal locus, of course, is not found in mother and is, because we've assumed each of these has a different father, is also not found in either of these siblings. And so the probability of a copy of this gene being in one of the siblings is greater for the maternal genes than for the paternal genes. And so we expect them to want to behave differently towards those relatives than the paternal genes. So that's a theoretical expectation. Indeed, there are several examples, about over a dozen now, examples of genes known which show parent-specific expression. So there are genes that are only active if they are inherited from the father, and other genes that are only active if they're inherited from the mother. There are two generalities we can say about these genes, very broad generalizations. First of all, that most of them, or at least more than you'd expect from a random sample of most genes, these are all from mice, more than you would expect by chance, are involved in growth, particularly fetal growth and placental growth, and so are somehow involved in the translocation of resources between mother and offspring. There's also a generalization, though there are exceptions, in which the generalization that paternally active genes are growth enhancers and maternally active genes are growth suppressors. IGF-2, for example, increases the presence of IGF-2, a paternally active gene, increases the size of the progeny by about 25%, whereas the presence of H19, on the other hand, reduces the size of the progeny by 20%, and that's a maternally active gene. That's a general tendency, though, as I say, there are exceptions. And things, of course, are more complicated. If we have a maternally imprinted gene here in one of the offspring, that means it somehow knows it came from mother, and it got an imprint. And one of the ideas of how it got that imprint is that it's due to methylation. So during gamete formation, during oogenesis in the mother, a methyl group was attached to the gene, and that methyl group can be inherited. If that's true, or however it is that happens, that this gene got an imprint from the mother, there must have been maternal genes that put the imprint on the mother. So there are maternal imprinting genes that put the imprint on, and maternally imprinted genes that receive the imprint. Now, these things are expected to evolve differently because the maternal imprinted gene that receives the imprint knows that it's traveling along with the imprint, so it knows it came from mother, in a sense, once it gets to the offspring. But the maternal imprinting genes that's putting the methyl groups on doesn't know that it's going to travel, be inherited along with the imprint. And so what it wants to do is slightly different. And, for example, a maternally imprinting gene is no more related to this offspring than to this offspring. And similarly, on the paternal side, there are paternal imprinting genes, presumably, and paternally imprinted genes. And the imprinted genes that carry the imprint know they are going along with the imprint and know that they came from father. The genes that put the imprint on the gene don't know that they're traveling along with the imprint, and so will have different selective forces on them. And finally, of course, there are the progeny genes in these progeny that have to decide whether they want to pay attention to the imprint or whether they want to ignore it or erase it. So we can draw a little picture. Here I've plotted the expected egoism or selfishness, or the optimal level of selfishness of by an offspring from different points of view. And I've just plotted that against the breeding system of the species from complete monogamy, where all the progeny of the mother have the same father, to complete promiscuity, where all the progeny of the mother have different fathers. And you can see that maternal imprinting genes don't know that they're traveling along with the imprint, and so are equally related to everybody, and so want to have a selfishness of one, a relative, don't weight anybody equally more than anybody else. Maternally imprinted genes travel along with the imprint, and so they know they're in the organism, but have only a half probability of being in a sibling, and so they have a score of 2. The paternal imprinting and imprinted genes start off the same in the case of monogamy, but then are selected for increasing amounts of selfishness as the probability of there being different fathers increases. and the progeny optimum is somewhere between the paternal and maternal imprinted genes. Okay, so things are complicated, and we can, for example, that means we can imagine genes that want to, genes that want to put an imprint on a gene, but that gene doesn't want to be imprinted. And so yeah, we could get the evolution of genes that lose the recognition site for the imprint. Or you might get genes that want to receive an imprint to be imprinted, but the imprinting gene doesn't want to put it on. And so you might there get the evolution of that gene mimicking other imprinted genes so that it can receive an imprint that the imprinting gene might not want to put on. And we might also expect to see genes that are imprinted fine in the parents, and then those imprints are ignored or erased in the progeny. So all this suggests that we should expect to see, when we look at the mechanism of imprinting, which we're just beginning to do, as molecular biologists are just beginning to do, it should be very complicated, and that's generally what we find. It doesn't seem to be simple so far, the mechanism of imprinting. Despite such complexity, I think there's probably one expectation we can have, which I'd like to propose, and that is that we should expect fathers to have more effect on the gene expression of their progeny than mothers do. And I say that for three reasons. First of all, imprinting is really the only way a father can influence how much progeny gets from its mother, whereas the mother has many different ways of influencing how much resources it gives to its progeny. So mother has many ways of influencing things, and the father really only has gametic imprinting to do it. Second of all, you can see these lines here. For the father, they go, particularly in the case of promiscuity, they go very high, a long way from one, and so selection pressures are higher in the case of male paternal imprinting rather than maternal imprinting. So selection pressures are higher. And finally, if the actual level of investment of mothers in their into their offspring is somewhere between maternal and progeny optimum, whatever those are, we should more often expect, I think, the progeny to agree with paternal imprints than to agree with maternal imprints. And so imprints from the father are more likely to be less likely to be ignored and more likely to be paid attention to by the progeny. Okay, so that's genomic imprinting. The last thing I would like to talk about today is the effect of breeding system on the evolution and ecology of selfish genes. You know, if I had to say one criteria of the host species that is probably most important in the evolution of selfish genes, of course there's many, but if there had to be just one single one, I would say it's the breeding system, and in particular whether it's outcrossed or inbred in the species. And I'll just show you why I think that and some evidence why I think that in the context of B chromosomes. So remember, B chromosomes are extra supernumerary chromosomes, and our general conception of them is that they are deleterious to the organism and can persist in populations only because they are inherited at a greater than Mendelian rate. Now that way of life, that strategy, presupposes an outcrossing population. If we consider instead a totally inbred or asexual population, some of which has B chromosomes and some individuals don't have B chromosomes, so if we consider a population, some fraction of which contain B chromosomes, because B chromosomes have these accumulation mechanisms, the average number of B chromosomes within this fraction of the population will increase over time. But the size of this fraction, because B chromosomes are deleterious, but the size of this fraction will get smaller and smaller, and eventually the B chromosomes will be lost. That's in the inbred or asexual case, when you have totally separate independent lineages between which there is selection. In the case of an outcrossed population, this fraction of the population that doesn't have B chromosomes is constantly being reinfected just through cross-fertilization. And so there's no separate lineages between which selection operates, And so it's only in that situation where parasitic selfish elements can persist. You can make a you can do a quantitative model, which I won't go through the details of. But if you plot in a particular case the proportion of individuals containing B chromosomes as a function of the O crossing rate, you see that if we just look at the top panel, in the case of obligate O crossing, there is some level of some prevalence of B chromosomes, and as the O crossing level falls and the population becomes more inbred, the level frequency of B chromosomes goes down until at some threshold level the B chromosomes cannot persist anymore and are lost from the population. Not surprisingly, you get the exact opposite result if you if you model the situation of a mutualistic B chromosome, which is beneficial to the organism but shows a drag at meiosis, as has been found in the chive as an example. So that means if B chromosomes are mostly parasitic, selfish, then we should expect to see them more often in O-cross species than in inbred species. And in fact, that seems to be true. So we collected data from the literature on the breeding system of British plants, 353 species of British plants, and categorized them as inbred, mixed, or outcrossed, and then looked up to see which ones are recorded as having B chromosomes. And you can see that for the inbred ones, 5.5% of them are recorded as having B chromosomes, 6.8% for the mixed, and 29% of the obligately outcrossed species are reported as having B chromosomes. And that is a very highly significant difference. And you can cut and slice the data in different ways along taxonomic lines, and again you get the same result, that obligately outcross species are more likely to have B chromosomes than inbred ones. Okay, so that's all I really want to say today. I hope I've convinced you that there are a huge diversity of selfish genes out there using a variety of strategies for getting about, and that they are worth thinking about. I've suggested that there's four main ways selfish genes have of biasing their inheritance, of first of all killing the competition, of showing directed movement towards the germline, of showing over-replication, so you get more than one replication per cell cycle, or of sex changing the sex of the organism to one more conducive to your own transmission. There's also conflicts of interest can arise over behavior of the organism towards relatives, particularly mothers and siblings. And along the way, we've considered such questions as why there might be a trade-off between short-term persistence, short-term success, fixation of a selfish gene and its long-term persistence, why recombination is so common in yeast, why the male-determining gene in some rodents has been duplicated, why sex ratio disorders, particularly opposing sex ratio disorders, tend to co-occur, why diesy is so rare in plants, why imprinting mechanisms are so complex, why we might expect fathers to have a greater influence on the gene expression of their progeny than mothers, why outcross species are more likely to have B chromosomes than inbred ones, and finally, why we see genes for flagellar dysfunction, endonucleases that cut chromosomes simply so they can be repaired, genes for pollen abortion, and the like. Thanks very much.
Well, thanks very much, Austin, for an absolutely fascinating talk. I'm conscious of having neglected my chairmanly duties to some extent at the beginning of this session. We had a very interesting discussion with Austin over lunch, and I was so anxious to hear his presentation that I rather forgot to introduce him properly, and I'm afraid I didn't tell you two important things in particular. So before we get on to the questions, I would just like to say, first of all, that Austin is, as he's amply demonstrated to us just now, not just an excellent replacement for Bob Trivers, but is also working very closely with Bob, and indeed is co-authoring a book with him. The second thing I'd like to say is that he is currently at Imperial College and is in the process of setting up a lab, quite apart from the work that he's trying to do at the moment and the work that he's doing with Bob Trivers. And I'm sure, on the basis of what he's just been telling us about, that we're going to hear of a stream of successful and interesting pieces of research coming out from that lab. Now, we have time.
I would just like to reiterate on that, that this work that I've presented, the orientation I've presented, has been completely worked out with Bob Trivers, and so this is a joint effort, just to make that clear.
Okay, we have a reasonable amount of time for questions. The theatre is somewhat cavernous, as you can see. Now, we do have some microphones which can be handed round, but we have found on previous occasions that a system which works quite well is if people will stand up in order to put their question, speak very clearly, and also it would be very helpful if questioners would give their name so that they are identifying themselves to members of the audience who might not already know. I'd like to exercise my chairman's privilege, if I may, and kick off by asking you to speculate in a way that you will probably think quite outrageous. You've been talking, amongst other things, about the, as it were, the matching styles of conflict that, or attempts to dominate that one might, that's one of the strategies that one can expect to see, and the well-worn phrase "battle of the sexes" occurred to me while you were talking. Now, that's a phrase which, of course, is usually reserved for behavior between whole organisms of male and female types. I wonder if you'd care to speculate and say whether you think that there's a possibility that the kind of conflict we see at a social level between individuals could have its basis in some of the genetic conflict that you're talking about.
Well, there's two issues. First of all, the genomic imprinting can be seen and has been described as the battle of the sexes going molecular, and in its sense that there is a maternal and a paternal half of the genome, and those might have different conflicts of interest, and so that's conflict within the organism, and so that's just a label you can use if you want, this battle of the sexes. The other issue is to what extent the real, what everybody thinks about is how the relationships between males and females within a species, to what extent that is impinged upon by selfish genes and intergenomic conflict. And the only example I can think of is a case, is a conflict of interest over inbreeding, where in general maternally imprinted genes in a female, maternally imprinted genes in a female are more likely to want inbreeding, incest, than paternally imprinted genes in the female. And it's the other way around in males, so that maternally imprinted genes in males are less likely to want inbreeding, incest, than paternally imprinted genes. But other than that very narrow issue over which there might be conflict, I don't know, over the wider issue of relations of the sexes, to what extent this solves that.
It wasn't a fair question at all. Yes, please.
My name is Mike Clark. In Dawkins' book, The Selfish Gene, he starts off in early chapters talking in very much the kind of terms you're talking, very deep focus. Surprisingly short order, he drop into animals and we're sort of equating selfish individuals with selfish animals. Isn't what you're saying really pointing out the inherent dangers of looking at evolution and trying to explain behaviours in terms of how does this enable the animal to get his genes on? Shouldn't, in fact, every analysis be in terms of how does this piece of behaviour enable the genes which code for it to persist? You know, or we invariably to look at everything from the point of view of selfish genes and not allow ourselves to drift off to what the animal does, you know, because?
Well, people might differ over this. To my mind, if you call everything selfish, then it loses its meaning. And just to say every gene is selfish, then you can just skip the word selfish and you just call it a gene. And yes, there's a sense in which what you say is true, no doubt. But I think there is an important logical distinction to be made between genes which have their success by contributing to organism survival or reproductive success and are inherited in a fair way along with all the others. That on the one hand, and the other situation where genes are positively harmful to the organism in which they reside. And that's an important logical distinction because it has effects on evolution. Because, for example, in one case you expect the evolution of suppressors and not in the other case. So I would prefer to restrict, well, that's why I chose to restrict the usage of the word selfish to that more restrictive case, to keep a meaning which is useful and can be distinguished from other cases, rather than calling everything the same thing.
Would you accept that's different from Dawkins?
Yes, absolutely, yes, and yes. It's a very good title for a book, but I don't know, it's not really used in current science, you know, it's not just me, but selfish genes now has come to mean, among evolutionary biologists, those that have deleterious effects.
You could say that we are organisms. Our whole mode of thought is individual-centric. We think about it for the organism. The whole of history is about telling us history of science, that we aren't the center of the world. In a sense, when you start distinguishing between gene behavior that you now want to call selfish because it's bad for me, isn't that just individual centricity again, imposing its perception of the universe on what ought to be a totally detached scientific analysis?
As you look at the world, you can try and make sense of it however you want, and there's no right way to use words, I don't think, just whatever. I think it's useful to keep this logical distinction between genes that are harmful to the organism and those that are beneficial, because that has implications, and it's important enough to have a word for it.
Richard.
Of genes, yes.
The bigger question perhaps I could ask you to comment on is it not even more amazing that there's any order out there at all, and that the whole structure, the set of rules, the norms, the Mendelian inheritance should be there at all to disrupt? And can you comment particularly on why we don't just see a slew of genes out there that we've got all the complexity of chromosomes and Mendelian inheritance?
In complete detail, no. There's little bits and pieces of light you can shed on the issue. Non-Mendelian inheritance usually leads to things that are detrimental to the organism, so detrimental to other genes within the organism, and so that selects for suppressors. And so there is positive selection to keeping genes, there's selection for genes to keep other genes in line, so to speak. And so those genes that are able to keep other genes in line will increase in frequency. And so that is the best answer I can give. It's not The complexity of Mendelian inheritance. I'm not which the molecular and no, certainly not. Bacteria show that they don't have proper Mendelian genetics. But yes, I think there is a sense that genes can increase in frequency. Well, it's not just a sense, it's just a statement. Genes can increase in frequency because they make sure meiosis is fair for everybody else, and so what they are attached with what they find themselves, the genes they find themselves with are genes that contribute to the organism. And so if you're surrounded by genes who are only there because they contribute to organism fitness rather than their own selfish interests, then that gene itself will benefit from all these other genes contributing to the fitness of the organism. If that makes sense.
Christopher Bagwell, LSE, you made a distinction which I didn't fully understand. I wonder if you could repeat it, because I guess a lot of people may not believe it. And that was between, I think you said, imprinted genes and imprinting genes. Is that right?
Yes.
If you could explain that again, because if you've got by me, could you give us an example?
The molecular details of genomic imprinting are not well known. One guess of how it works is that sometime during during sperm formation or egg formation, the DNA is modified by sticking these methyl groups. It's just it's a carbon and some other atoms onto the DNA, And so that's an enzymatic reaction. That somehow this gene is getting something stuck onto it, and there has to be enzymes that are doing this sticking on. And so those enzymes, and there's one case I know where they've found an actual gene that does this. That mutations at one gene will affect the imprinting status of another gene. And so this gene over here is the imprinted gene in the methyl group or not. Or somehow receiving the imprint. And then there are other genes that are putting that imprint on, that's somehow necessary for the methyl transferases and whatever enzymes do that sort of thing. And my point was just you expect different things of those two sorts of genes. They do not necessarily agree. Lawrence? Certainly, I don't want to give the idea that I am a firm believer in that. What do I want to say here? We don't know all the answers for the evolution of genomic imprinting. We don't even know most of the phenomena. We just have a handful of genes which have been found more or less serendipitously rather than are trying to make sense of what has been found so far. And there's a lot more to be discovered, certainly. MASH2, and I thought there was only one of those regions rather than two, but I'm not of the disomies, whether it's one or two exceptions. The X chromosome case seems to be tied up and I don't know how you can untangle it from the effects of X inactivation, which is a different phenomenon. So whether that's really a counterexample, it doesn't seem clear to me. But yes, and even, well, MASH too, yes, it's needed in development of a certain part of the placenta, but I don't, you know, they still don't, I understand, we were just talking about this earlier today, that we don't really know what it does in the placenta. Yes, it's necessary for it, but is it an enhancer or what? And this is one of the maternally imprinted genes. So yes, there's lots of things that we don't understand about imprinting. And it seems to me, at the very least, the logic that I've suggested and others have suggested, certainly before me, is going to be important. It will be a constant tendency within evolution, whether it is the only thing impacting on the evolution of genomic imprinting is, we don't know yet. Can't be more precise than that. Yes?
Thank you.
A very crude question, but in the example you gave of genomic imprinting, where you first think it's a mammal, and how a pattern of variation might be related to different breeding patterns in different social systems, the question that I was being interested in the difference between social systems, would we therefore expect, given that if you take any group of mammals, the social system varies from species to species, and indeed from within species to population to population, would we expect to find different levels of patterns of variation in genetic instances at that scale? Or is this a scale of variation that really characterizes whole orders of mammals?
Again, we don't know. All the work that's been done on imprinting is on mice and mice and humans, or more or less. And there are a couple genes in which the imprinting status does differ between mice and humans, but we don't know more than that. I would certainly expect that, yes, you know, there's all this variety within rodents that in social systems, and that is one of the most obvious things that, you know, it's molecular biologists that have been doing all this, and they're not comparative biologists. And so a comparative study of gene parental specific gene expression across a range of rodents of different social systems would be a brilliant thing to do. And probably not all that difficult. Once you've got genes that, you know, we know several genes to look at, we would just be able to assay them, I suspect, not all that difficultly in a range of species. But we don't know the answer yet. Certainly there are clear predictions made by the theory. Yes? Seems to me, if there was group selection working in the case of male sterility in plants, there's no reason to expect it always to be cytoplasmic. The induced mutation work shows that there are more mutation. You know, if you just wait for a mutation to happen that causes male sterility, it's more likely to be nuclear rather than cytoplasmic. Yet we see the actual genes we see in nature that have been through the selective sieve are predominantly cytoplasmic. So that would be my reason for discounting group selection. With the lemon case, I don't know if we, well, in the lemon case, it can't be an accident that it's, is it, can it? It can't be an accident that it's on the X chromosome. because, you know, that's the one that's benefiting. Whereas on, under this scenario, if it was any, if it was a group selection scenario, you might expect it to be on, just on any autosome. Certainly, the groups, well, or not the group selection per se, but a local mate competition argument has been used in the case of lemmings. And that was, that's indeed the traditional explanation for why they showed, why X, this driving X chromosome is allowed to persist in the lemmings, because there is some amount of inbreeding. I haven't seen any good data that there is actually any inbreeding in lemmings and any scenario leading to local mate competition, so I don't see any evidence for that. But it's curious why you don't see, you know, there's these lemmings, and it sounds like maybe Acodon, another rodent group, have these XY females. But it's a little curious why it isn't more widespread within mammals. One reason might be, like in humans, it requires that an XY individual be able to grow up into a female, which is haploid at the X chromosome. In humans, it seems we don't get that happening, because at least XO females are sterile. So that's not a viable, so for XO rodent, mice are viable and fertile, but XO humans are not. And so in humans anyway, we could not, this strategy of the dominant feminizer X chromosome could not evolve. Within mammals, generally, how many of them tend to be more like the mouse or more like the human, I don't know what the range is. Some of this difference is due to differences in dosage compensation. Different genes undergo X inactivation and dosage compensation in different ways in rodents versus humans. And birds have a different system of dealing with that sort of thing. So I honestly don't know whether that strategy is viable in birds, but it might be. Yeah, it requires more thought and more facts, probably. But it's also a question why we don't see it in insects or, you know, a whole range of organisms. Yes, in the back. In reverse order, if you're referring to the P elements in Drosophila that transpose only in the germline and not in somatic cells, there are, how does that work? The P element codes for a gene, a transposase. That transposase is necessary to chop out the transposable element and move it elsewhere in the genome. So that transposase is a gene that's coded for by a gene that's got introns. That gene is only correctly spliced in the germline and not correctly spliced in somatic line. And also, so presumably, the gene that makes the transposase is incorrectly spliced in the somatic cells, and so that's why you don't get any movement in somatic cells. And so presumably, the P element is exploiting some attribute of the organism which it uses to preferentially turn on some genes in the germline and preferentially turn others off in somatic cells of differential splicing within germ and soma. And so presumably there is such a thing which the P element is taking advantage of. How ancient are transposable elements? They've been found in every organism that has been looked at. What more can we say than that? There is very good evidence of horizontal transmission of P elements between species. So the P element, for example, just was introduced into Drosophila melanogaster just this century and has subsequently swept through the whole worldwide population. So they certainly can move horizontally. So what do we know? Certainly there's a great diversity of transposable elements, and if you make molecular trees, you know, they can be very difficult to align. They've diverged so much that they can be difficult to align. And so that says they haven't arisen 1,000 years ago. They're older than that. But whether we can, they're also known in bacteria. There's no reason to say they haven't been there since as long as life. But to say we have positive evidence of that, it's just purely based on the diversity, I think, and the fact that they're in everything. And I don't quite know what number that puts a bound on, but so that's as good as I can tell you. First question was, it's possible. It seems to me that a gene, if imprinting, if it's a growth promoting gene and imprinting turns it off, for example, then maternally imprinting gene might want to turn it off, but it doesn't want to be turned off because it knows it's in the offspring, and so the for example, or that's the easiest case to see it in. So maternal imprinting genes are found with equal probability in all progeny, so they don't want too selfish a progeny, so they'll suppress a growth enhancer. That gene that is being turned off by the imprint travels along with the imprint into that progeny, and once it doesn't want to be turned off necessarily. You know, it depends on the exact B's and C's, but so there's an example where a gene might not want to be imprinted, and in that case might evolve to lose the recognition sequences used by the imprinting genes or imprinting machinery. Male killers as in PSRB chromosomes or as in cytoplasmic elements? Cytoplasmic elements. I've never heard of a cytoplasmic male. There are elements in insects, particularly other arthropods, that will kill, that are cytoplasmically inherited. They're bacterium. I didn't treat them because it's a whole organism rather than just a gene, typically, and that are inherited vertically through, and inherited like mitochondria, just through female line. And so being for, just like for mitochondria, being in a male is a dead end. And so some of these will kill if they find themselves in a male, they will kill them. And certainly there are many examples of those known. Is any example of such a thing known in which they stop killing once they get to high frequency, somehow can detect the frequency and stop killing? I've never heard of such a thing. And third question, would you ever expect, if that was possible, would you expect it to be selected for? Probably. That's not necessarily by group selection, though, but by because once males get very limiting, then if there's any inbreeding, then those males are preferentially going to mate with their females and allow those sisters to create progeny. So even if we were to see such a thing, that would not necessarily have anything to do with group selection. Sickle cell. Yes, my... why is that relevant? Yes. Okay, well, I mean, I'm talking about net effects, and I'm talking, yes. I just want, they go together. If you're deleterious, if you, on average you're deleterious for the organism, then you're going to be lost from the population unless you've got something else, and like a more than Mendelian rate of transmission. So, yes, they go together, and I wouldn't say one is primary over the other. Sickle cell has a net effect, which is depends on the environment. If you're in Africa or North America, that goes to some intermediate frequency.
Well, if there are no more questions, we can now break for tea. There's tea and biscuits in the foyer. We reconvene at 5:30, and we will need to start promptly because we are under orders to be out at 7:00 sharp. So 5:30, please, for part two. And thank you very much again, Austin, for a most stimulating presentation.
And the hormones which more closely mimic the events that occur in pregnancy, that is progesterone priming followed by estrogen, are more effective in producing that behavioral response. However, if we look at monkeys, then the picture is somewhat different, because female primates that have not been pregnant, that have not gone through parturition, are quite capable of showing maternal behavior. Indeed, what you will see is they often go and try and kidnap infants and try and look after them, and you find that mothers are very protective of their infants and will only allow younger sisters, for example, to nurse them. And humans too, for that matter. You don't have to have gone through pregnancy and parturition in order to be a perfectly good mother adopting children. On the other hand, you can have gone through pregnancy and parturition and actually turn out to be not such a good mother. So this deterministic effects of hormones is somewhat reduced as we move up this phylogenetic scale. If we look at maternal behavior in monkeys, and many years ago, Harlow did studies where he isolated monkeys, or he raised them with a surrogate mother, or he raised them together with peers but without contact to mother. And the outcome of these experiments showed us that social factors were probably the most important factors, these rearing social factors were most important in determining whether those infants were going to be good mothers or not. And here you see, these are the infants that were reared in a wire cage, a cloth surrogate, or together, that is, with other monkeys. And what you find is that a lot of these animals show inadequate sexual behavior, inadequate maternal behavior when they grow up, and indeed, a large proportion of them show abusive behavior. As we move more towards a social condition of together monkeys, that is, peers reared together, what you see is the inadequate behavior goes down and the adequate behavior goes up. Nevertheless, these females are still abusive. So here we're seeing, again, an important component of the social environment during rearing that is influencing that behavior, and we don't see the same kind of effects through the hormones. And we can, in a very simplistic way, and I apologize to the neuroscientists here for the simplistic diagram, but it helps me to explain what I think has been happening in terms of hormonal regulation of maternal and sexual behavior in primate and non-primate mammals. This is what we might call a typical non-primate mammal with a relatively large limbic brain and a relatively small cognitive brain. Now, this limbic brain is subjected to external environmental cues, photoperiod, pheromones, auditory and tactile cues. And indeed, there are neural pathways going directly into this part of the brain. And this part of the brain controls the neuroendocrine interactions that occur. And so as a result of these different environmental cues, what happens is the neuroendocrine part of the brain is activated. That switches on the gonad, and then the gonad feeds back to the brain, feeds back the hormones that activate the behavior. In other words, the cue from the environment is only effective if the gonads are intact, and it brings about the interaction or the action through the gonad. In other words, the decision process is taken here. If we move up and look at primates, first of all, there are no old world primates, to the best of my knowledge, that respond directly to any of these cues. Nevertheless, these cues are important, and so too are social cues, but they're not important in themselves, they're important as part of polymodal information, which is not only integrated across the cues, but it's integrated according to the animal's social rank, and it's integrated according to the past experiences of that individual. And as a result of the decision process being taken here, then that activates the limbic brain, that activates the behavior, and the endocrinology follows. The gonads are switched on as a consequence of the events here. You can manipulate events that are occurring here and here, for example, in terms of social status, and that'll have downstream consequences for endocrinology. If you castrate the animals, then that doesn't necessarily stop sexual behavior. Indeed, rhesus monkeys have been shown to be showing sexual behavior several years after castration. And actually, if you take out the ovaries of females, what you paradoxically see is they actually increase their invitation to males. That's probably because the hormone does still have somatic effects. It has somatic effects in terms of the attractiveness of these females. So if they're less attractive, they have to work harder by the behavioral output to induce the male to show interest in them. Well, then the third part of this I want to talk about is the importance, the way social cues have now become very important in determining the behavior. I'm going to talk about this with respect to the talapoin monkey, an old world primate that has a true menstrual cycle of about 30 days. And if we look at the behavior of these monkeys, the sexual behavior first of all, what we see, this is taken for seven groups of animals, and what we see is the sexual behavior is not evenly distributed. Sexual behavior is highly dependent on rank. Not only is it highly dependent on rank, but unless you're in the top ranking individuals in this particular species, you get totally excluded from sexual behavior. And you can give these low ranking individuals, you can massive doses of testosterone, non-physiological doses of testosterone, and it doesn't do anything for their sexual behavior. You cannot induce them to be sexually active in a social group after they've experienced social subordination. If we look at the females, on the other hand, then we see the patterning is somewhat different. Females, there's still a hierarchy, and there's still a hierarchy with respect to sexual activity. But all females are showing sexual activity. All females are sexually active. All females have the potential to be fertilized and become pregnant. If we look at other behaviors, and here we're looking at intrasexual, aggressive behavior and affiliative behavior, that is in all male groups or all female groups, and again we see these behaviors too are very different according to the sexes. What we see is males score very high on attacks and threats. Females score very low on these behaviors. A very mild form of aggression displaced is no different between males and females. Huddling and grooming, affiliative behaviors are very low in males, whereas huddling and grooming are very high in females. What we mean by huddling is this: females sitting together like this with their tails coiled around each other, and occasionally they also put their arms around each other, and you don't see that in the males. You see it in males and females, but you don't see it in males. Now, if we let the males and the females interact together, we're going into a heterosexual condition now, but we're looking at the behavior, male-male behavior, and what we're seeing is anything above this line is an increase and below it is a decrease, and likewise here. What you see is that when the males and females interact, the strategy changes in such a way that the males increase their overt aggressive behavior, but the mild form of behavior displacement doesn't change, whereas females actually reduce their overt pattern of behavior. If we look at huddling and grooming, that decreases in males and it doesn't change in females. And if we look at how these kinds of behavior develop by taking all of the behaviors that can occur and doing time sequence analysis on the data, so we're asking the question here, what happens when a dominant male approaches a female, and what happens when a subordinate male approaches a female? And these arrows are drawn to scale, so dominant males approach about twice as much as subordinates. And when dominants approach, mounting is most likely to follow. Aggression and withdrawal are relatively rare. But when subordinates approach females, the most likely behaviors to follow are aggression or withdrawal from that female, and sexual behavior is less likely to occur. So these strategies for the males, clearly, subordinate males, whenever they're getting interested in females, are going to be subjected to a fairly obnoxious behavior, either aggression or some other form of behavior that results in their withdrawing. If we look at females, on the other hand, their strategies are rather different. Females, dominant females and subordinate females, both solicit males, dominants more frequently. When dominants solicit, they're more likely to have a mount compared with subordinates. Aggression is extremely low in both of them. But if we look at the solicits by other females, when a subordinate female solicits the males, the most likely behavior to follow is solicits from other females. So there is female competition for males, but there is not suppression of the female's behavior. On the contrary, this is higher than what you see here. So they're not being suppressed, but they are competing. Well, I mentioned these differences, these social differences, and these differences in terms of the emancipation of brain mechanisms from endocrine state, because if you're moving away from a strict endocrine determinant, which is so strict that you can set your watch by it, it's absolutely essential that in whatever determines whether sexual behavior occurs or not, that decision is right. You get that decision right, both for sexual behavior and maternal behavior. Therefore, it's important that you develop what we might call a larger brain. And the suggestion has been made that the push for larger brains stems from social living. But what I've just told you is that in most simian primates, social living does not produce equivalent selection pressures for males and females. It's almost as if we're looking at different species when we look at the males and females in terms of their behavioral strategies. We see females are more affiliative, and they provide the socially cohesive force. And if we look further than the lab studies to work that's been done in the females, females are important for group stability, the continuity of which is maintained over successive generations through the matriline. This is true for a lot of Cercopithecus monkeys. Likewise, in Cercopithecus monkeys, we see high-ranking females produce more daughters, and these daughters are themselves more likely to become high-ranking and be reproductively successful. Males, on the other hand, tend to migrate from the natal social group, are more aggressive, less affiliative, and if anything, socially disruptive. So there are very marked differences between the males and females. Now, in trying to come on to the next part of my talk, in order to try and come up with some genetic mechanism, we don't really want to be looking at a sex-linked mechanism, but we do want to be looking at something where the selection pressures are operating differently through males and females. And for that reason, I've looked at the way genomic imprinting affects brain development. Now, you've already heard from Austin, who was speaking earlier, that what happens in genomic imprinting, the alleles are inherited in a normal Mendelian way, but they're not expressed in a normal Mendelian way. There are some alleles that come through the matriline that are only expressed when they come through the matriline, and there are other alleles which come through the patriline which are only expressed when they appear through the patriline. So these are autosomal alleles which have what is known as parent of origin expression. Now, in order to look at these, two indications suggest to me that they have been important in terms of brain development. One comes from the clinical studies, part of the spin-off of the work that's done on the Human Genome Project, and these are concerned with human genetic disorders. One of these is Angelman syndrome, and the other one is Prader-Willi syndrome. Angelman syndrome is maternally transmitted, and Angelman syndrome is characterized by mental retardation and puppet-like movements. And this is actually, so what is happening here, this is maternal transmission, but not paternal transmission, and this, usually what happens here is you get a disomy occurring, paternal disomy, but what is happening here is, you're not, or one of part of the chromosomes is deleted. But this is not a deletion of a chromosome, this is a point mutation that is producing this, a point mutation in the maternally expressed allele. What happens on Prader-Willi, on the other hand, this is a paternally expressed allele, and this allele, if it is deleted or you have a maternal disomy at this locus, then what happens is the offspring tend to show hyperphagia and obesity and hyposexuality. So we got two parts of the brain being differentially influenced in humans by these imprinted genes, which are found on chromosome 15q11, and one is influencing what we might call higher order functioning, and the other is influencing what we could categorize as limbic functioning. Now the question is, we can't get at this experimentally in humans, but we can get at it experimentally in experimental animals, mice in particular. One way that we can get at it is to make mice which are disomic for the maternal autosomes, that is to say, parthenogenetic or gynogenetic, or vice versa. We can make mice which are androgenetic, that is to say, all their autosomal alleles are paternal. But when you do that, it's lethal. It doesn't survive, those animals don't survive before very early stages of post-implantation development. So in order to find out what is happening, so far as the brain's concerned, and the brain develops very much later in development than that, in order to find out what is happening in the brain, it's important to actually use these disomic cells, but put them into normal embryos and produce a chimera. So you have a normal embryo of which some cells are disomic for either the maternal genome or disomic for the paternal genome. And if you put a marker on those cells, like Z marker or blue marker in this case, you can see where those cells are going. Now let me emphasize that the proportion of cells you can put in there are way under 50%. If you put 50% or over, it's lethal. So these chimeras, the blue cells, are really about 30% of the total. And this is an embryo in which the blue cells are disomic for the maternal genome. The blue cells are expressing all of the imprinted alleles that are maternally expressed exclusively. And this is an AG chimera, and that the converse is true of that. It's disomic for the paternal alleles. And what you can see, well, first of all, this embryo, these are matched for developmental time, and this one is smaller than this one. But what you can see is here, the blue cells are very well represented in the brain, but they're not well represented in the brain here. And the blue cells here are well represented in the body and less well represented in the body here. Not only that, but if we look at the brain, this is a normal control brain, postnatal brain. This is a brain which has an increased dosage. It has these maternal disomic cells in, so you're increasing the dosage of those exclusively maternally expressed cells. And this one is a brain from a chimera which is androgenetic, and therefore you're increasing the dosage of the exclusively paternally expressed genes. And when you do that, I think you can see that the cortex, or the forebrain, is bigger with the maternal increased dosage of maternal alleles, and the androgenetic cortex is somewhat smaller. The brain stem itself is no different, and we can see that represented more formally here. These are control, this is brain size against body weight, and these are the chimeras. And what you see is, although your controls tend to have higher body weight, even at a given point between 30 and 35 grams, there's what we call a grade shift here, a highly significant increase in the size of the brain when we increase the dosage of those alleles which are expressed exclusively from the matriline. If we look more closely at the brain, again, this is an AG chimera and this is a PG chimera. And if we look through the brain, what we can see here, this is a black and white photograph, I'll show you a color one in a minute. Here you have, this is a sagittal section, here you have the cortex and striatum. This, each of these cells that you can see here are disomic for the paternal genome, and each of the cells here are disomic for the maternal genome. And what you can see is, of course, you get very many more of them in the cortex and striatum than you do here with the AGs. If we move down now to the hypothalamus, This is the posterior hypothalamus. Here's the pituitary going down into the medial basal hypothalamus, ventromedial up here to the preoptic area. There's your optic chiasm. Now you see that the AG cells are very prevalent in this area, but they are absent in this area when those cells are disomic from maternal alleles. So what you're seeing is a very marked difference in the distribution of these cells within the brain, a marked effect on the development of the brain, and a reciprocal distribution with respect to limbic brain and respect to the executive brain. Here we're looking at the same thing with a blue marker. Here you have the cortex, and these are PG cells, blue cells. There are one or two blue cells in the cortex here with an AG, but virtually none at all. Whereas if we look down in the hypothalamus, there are lots of cells which are AG, and virtually excluded from the hypothalamus are the PG cells. And if we actually formally measure this by counting at different developmental days, what we're looking at here are AG control. These are just normal cells that are put in there with the marker so you can see what proportion are going where. There are going to be many more of these than there are of these, by the way, in total. And these are the PG cells. And what you can see in cortex and striatum is these proliferate, whereas the AG cells are excluded. Whereas when we go to the hypothalamus, the AG cells proliferate relative to normal, and the PG cells are excluded. And the same occurs at a certain later stage as well. So we're getting very marked differences then in the distribution of these cells with respect to the different parts of the brain. Now, the next question I want to ask is, if we take those parts of the brain to which we find a differential contribution of maternal and paternal genome, what is happening to those parts of the brain over evolutionary time, at least over phylogenetic time, first of all? And what we're looking at here are insectivores, prosimians, and simians. And we're looking here on your left, these are the areas of the brain to which the maternal alleles, where the maternal alleles predominate, and here on the right, in hypothalamus septum, are those where you get the paternal alleles predominating. And the first thing you'll see is that these lines in both cases are isometric. They go through zero. Secondly, you'll see there's a very good correlation going on here. It's 0.986, which is about as good as you can get in biological data. This suggests to me that at least within these categories, these areas over phylogenetic time have been evolving together. They're all on the same line. Now what happens if we look at these parts of the brain compared with any other part, or these parts of the brain compared with any other part? Here, we're looking at those parts of the brain which I've parsimoniously called executive, saving me talking about neocortex, striatum, hypothalamus, and septum every time. So these, I call them executive, I've controlled for body weight, and I'm comparing them, again, with a part of the brain which is phylogenetically old, the brainstem, and a part of the brain in which there is no differential distribution of disomic maternal or disomic paternal cells. So this is what we might call an imprinted, genomically imprinted neutral part of the brain. And again, we're controlling for body weight. And now what we're looking at are insectivores, prosimians, and simians. And what you can see is that the executive brain, because of this grade shift here, the executive brain relative to this other part of the brain is increasing significantly over phylogenetic time. These are highly significant differences that you're getting. You no longer have a single line that you can put through those. You have three different lines, and none of these lines, in fact, are isometric. If we look now at the other parts of the brain, hypothalamus and septum, what I've called here for, again, parsimoniously fits into the category of emotional brain, what you see here now is they too are separate, but now what you see is that it's the insectivores that have the highest part, the highest or largest, relatively largest emotional brain, followed by the prosimians, followed by the simians. If I just quickly go back, here you see, there's the insectivores and there's the simians, but they've switched now. There's the insectivores and there's the simians. So what is happening is the brain isn't evolving or isn't changing over phylogenetic time in a unitary way. It's not simply that the brain is getting bigger, it's remodeling itself. Some parts, And those parts to which we see the maternal genome plays a strong contribution are getting bigger, and other parts, those to which the paternal genome makes a particular contribution, are actually getting smaller. So, the question I want to ask now are, what are the selective pressures that have influenced brain evolution? And I did mention briefly that it's been suggested by a lot of people that one of the pressures is living socially. And if we look at group size, an executive brain and emotional brain, we see that there is a tendency that with increased group size, so the executive brain is tending to get bigger, whereas with increased group size, the emotional brain is tending to get smaller. However, I have it on good authority from those people who work on evolution and look in terms of what the selection pressures have been, this is not sufficient. It's not sufficient because a number of these points represent individuals that are phylogenetically related. So for here, for example, we have a very large contribution from the prosimians. So we have to control for phylogenies. And in order to do that, we have to do an analysis which takes into account the primate phylogenetic tree. This is taken from Andy Purvey's data, and indeed it was his program, his CAKE program, Comparative Analysis Using Independent Contrast, which looks at all of the branches for these different primates and where the branches break and the branch lengths, and puts a weighting on them according to the relatedness or non-relatedness. Don't ask me any questions about that. I just use this to look at it in this way. The other thing we have to do is we have to, when we're looking at a given category, a selective event like group size or diet or whatever, there's no point looking at phylogenies because we have to control for that. So we take the population as a whole and we draw the best fit line through the whole of that population. And then what you do is, here I've marked large group and small group with different color codes, but essentially what you do is you look and see how individuals that are in one category or other deviate from this line. In other words, how far they are above the line, or how far they are below the line, or how far they are on the line, or whether they're on the line. And this kind of analysis produces residuals. And the residuals look something like this. These are the residuals of the executive brain regressed on the rest of the brain. And what you can see is that with respect to the normal distribution, those animals that live in relatively small groups tend to have lower than the population at large, smaller than the population at large executive brains, whereas those that are in big groups tend to have larger executive brain with respect to the whole population. And vice versa, if we look at the emotional brain, those individuals which are small group tend to have a larger emotional, and those enlarged tend to have a smaller emotional. They're below the line and above the line. In other words, there's an association. Large brain is associated with large group living. We can also look at whether male or females are determining this difference that we see. And if we look at multi-female group versus single female group, and again we're looking at the residuals of the executive brain regressed on the rest of the brain, and what you see is that multi-female groups tend to have a larger executive brain than the population at large, where single female in a group tends to have a smaller. If we look at males, on the other hand, there's no difference between multi-male and single male with respect to the executive brain size. Another feature that we can look at is mating. Now, you remember at the beginning I made a big point about mating and whether once you've emancipated mating, brain mechanisms of mating from endocrine state, it's important that you get it right. And in getting it right, one of the things you need is a big cortex. And what we see is that those individuals which have a restricted mating, their executive brain tends to be below the population normal, whereas those which have a diffuse or an extended mating have a very much larger executive brain. But this is the primate population as a whole. And this is significant when you analyze it independently of phylogenies. If we look at diet now, what we see is that diet really doesn't do very much to the executive brain. You can see that folivores tend to have a smaller executive brain relative to the rest of the population, and frugivores tend to be slightly bigger, but that's non-significant. And what you do see significant is folivores tend to have a very much larger emotional brain. And oh, there was one more. No, there's a range as well. If we look at range, what you see is that range, those primates which have a longer, greater range tend to have a larger, those tend to feature higher on the size of emotional brain. So, finally then, I want to come on to what are the costs and what are the constraints on developing a bigger brain. And Bob Martin has shown, first of all, that in primates, their brains tend to be larger even in the early postnatal period. These are log neonatal body weight against log neonatal brain weight. And even in the immediate postpartum period, in very early in development, primates tend to have a larger brain, bigger brain weight than non-primates. Now, as you probably know, brain tissue is said to be very costly because brain tissue is extremely metabolically active, and therefore this is going to cost mothers quite a lot in terms of their investment, both prenatally and postnatally in weaning. The amount of energy the mother has to impart to an animal that has a bigger brain is going to be somewhat greater, if that is the only factor we need to take into account. However, there are two other points that I want to make here in this context. One concerns how local cerebral glucose utilization has changed from looking, this is at a rat, and this is at a monkey, and here we see rat brain as a whole and the monkey brain as a whole, and you can see that glucose utilization, micromoles per 100 grams per minute, that's controlling for time, controlling for weight, is very much less than what it is in rats. But I particularly draw your attention to those parts of the brain that have expanded greater in primates, namely the cortex, and here you see this is a rat and this is the cortex, and this bigger development, the greater development of this part of the brain, you see a bigger difference here in the metabolic activity. Whereas if we look at a tissue like the hypothalamus, which if anything has gone relatively smaller as we move up that phylogenetic scale, the difference is not nearly so marked. So that's one way, if you like, that developing a large brain can be compensated for in terms of metabolic activity. Another way in which it can be compensated for is the relative growth stages. Now, this data is taken from a human brain. As far as I know, I don't have this data on non-human primates. But what you're looking at here is brain growth and body growth with the dotted line. And what you see is that brain growth is peaking here prenatally at a time when body growth is quite small. Then it drops down. Then body growth appears. And then brain growth comes up in a second growth spurt. And then they both go down together. So by, as it were, desynchronizing these growths, these tissues and their growth, so they're not all growing equally at the same time at the same rate, then you can, as it were, distribute the energy requirements. One other point I'd like to make, and this goes back to genomic imprinting, and that is when you increase the contribution of the maternally expressed alleles, when you increase that dosage and you get a bigger brain, you also get a smaller body. And here you can see these animals rarely go above 30 to 35. And if you look, this is adult, but if you look in the neonate, this is even more exaggerated. In fact, I'll show you some neonates now. This is a chimera, a PG chimera, which has about 30% chimeric cells, which are disomic for the maternal genome. And you see, this is its littermate, which is a control, a very much greater difference in terms of body size. It has a bigger brain, but it has a much smaller body. And the other thing we see with genomic imprinting is with the AG chimeras. Here are your controls. This is your brain size against body size. Whereas if you look at the AG chimeras, that is, you've now increased the contribution from the paternal genome, and what you see is although these have a smaller brain size, they have an enormous body size relative to that. Whereas what you see here is the brain, normal animals, the slope is here, and what you see is the brain size in these are the lowest end of the scale, but the body size is far higher, at the great higher end of the scale than what you see in normal animals. So genomic imprinting, the consequences of that are not, as it were, in conflict with brain and body development relative to each other. So finally then, these are the conclusions that I want to draw. First of all, the mammalian brain has not evolved as a unitary structure. Certain parts have increased in size relative to the others, and these I've called executive, but really what they are specifically is the neocortex and the striatum. And certain parts have decreased in size relative to others. And these are parts which are concerned with primary motivated behavior. These are the parts of the brain that take up steroid hormones and respond to steroid hormones. And they have decreased, relatively speaking. And this remodeling of the brain occurs in areas where parent of origin dependent gene expression is active. If we look at the selection pressures that have influenced these changes, well, they've been multiple, but social factors have been particularly important. Group size, the number of females in the group, and emancipation of female reproductive behavior from hormonal determinants are all significantly related or correlated to increased executive brain size. Emotional brain size is negatively related to group size, but is positively related to home range and positively related to diet, as I said to you in the case of folivores. The emancipation of reproductive behavior from hormonal variables in simian primates, together with sex differences in social behavior that result in females being socially cohesive, are congruent with a remodeling of the brain that is linked to genomic imprinting. I have no problems with that. What we see and what we observe from the experiments are all congruent with this statement here, that emancipation of the brain mechanisms for reproductive behavior and the switch to the importance of social variables, because social variables need to take into account multiple behavioral interactions, need to take into account past experiences, knowledge of self with respect to others in terms of the status and dominance hierarchy. And they seem to me all functions of executive brain. And they are congruent with what I've said to you about genomic imprinting and brain development. And then finally, when we look at the costs of developing a larger brain, well, the metabolic costs of developing a large brain are facilitated by extending brain development in the postnatal period, what we call neoteny, desynchronizing it from body growth, adjusting body size at birth, increased relative brain to body size, and by changing the metabolic activity of these different brain tissues. So the neocortex, the tissue that is enlarging most, seems to be less demanding metabolically than tissue which is expanding least, like the hypothalamus. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much indeed. Just before I open the meeting for questions, could I once again ask you, when you put your question, to stand up, to speak loud and clear so that everybody can hear, and to give your name as well. And once again, I'd like, if I may, to exert my chairman's privilege and ask the first question. You've talked a good deal about social factors here. A lot of your data have been correlational, but I've rather taken the implication that you think of these social factors as somehow being causal. And is that the way it is? Is it social factors that are leading to the increase in executive parts of the brain, do you think? Or could it be the other way around? Could it be that the increase in the executive parts of the brain could in fact simply be providing the means for dealing with more complex social situations?
Yeah, I mean, when you have these correlations, you can't actually say which is taking the lead and which is not taking the lead. It seems to me that they're going together, and that one thing for sure, you cannot develop these intelligent behavioral strategies, or at least you can develop them better if you have a larger brain. And therefore, I see them as moving together rather than, you know, one necessarily taking the lead over the other. I think that maybe the initial push, we can't tell because I don't know anything about the behavior of extinct primates, but one would imagine that the initial push came principally from environmental events. But once you've got this initial push and you're developing a bigger cortex, then there are lots of things that you can do with it. And those lots of things you can do with it are very different in males and females, and so it goes on from there. It kind of escalates. I don't think you can kind of earmark either one thing or the other thing starting it. I mean, if I had to guess, and it would be a guess because we don't know what happened millions of years ago, I would imagine that it would be the environment, the physical, the ecological factors which were initially important. I mean, one thing that I haven't mentioned, and that is that I've been talking here particularly about primates, but for those mammals for which there is a good history in the fossil records, the brain has been increasing in all mammals that they have fossil records for. It's just that it hasn't been increasing as much, say, in horses as it has in primates. So, I mean, all mammals, in other words, it's a good thing to develop a bigger brain, and I think that they've been doing that. Please. Well, I'm no authority on metabolic activity in the brain. In fact, the data that I presented to you came as a bit of a surprise to me. I was looking to see what we could find on metabolic activity by going through papers and by going through neuroscience textbooks to see if we could find anything. And much to my surprise, you see, I always thought, being naive, that a tissue is a tissue and the metabolic activity will be the same regardless of which species it is in. That seems not to be the case. Maybe that is because the primate brain has more glia there, which are less metabolically demanding per unit area, per unit weight, than a rodent brain. I doubt that. But I suppose as you get more neurons, you also get more axons, and those axons are myelinated, and fat is very low in its metabolic activity. But in answer to your specific question about whether the metabolic activity is greater in the male brain than the female brain, I don't know the answer to that. I would have thought some of the 2DG work or the PET scans would have shown that up by now, if it's true. Do you know whether that data came from recent PET scans? I'm afraid I can't answer that, because I just don't know the answer. Right. Right.
And I think that's probably the key, both to your, it not costing quite as much to grow it, but also, if you like, maybe it's more.
Yeah, and if it has more connections, then presumably it has more dendrites, and presumably there's more myelin there, which, as I say, or at least there are more projections to it, so there are more likely to be more myelinated axons there, which is less metabolically demanding. Right. Yeah, sure.
Christopher? Christopher Back, I'll get to you. Linking up your talk to the previous one, there seemed to be an implication that you were saying that if maternally active and paternally active genes build different parts of the brain, then what those parts of the brain do ought to benefit them, in the sense that, as we heard in the first one, a maternally active gene, for example, knows that it's related to its mother by one, definitely its mother. So is there an implication in what you're saying? Maternally active genes build parts of the brain which then benefit, for example, maternal relatives?
Well, first of all, when I say maternally active alleles are important in this. What we see in these studies, these chimeric studies, is an exaggeration of that. And really what is happening in the normal embryo is there's an interaction between both maternal and paternal going on, and you definitely need both. You can't have one without the other. Now, in terms of which is contributing more to one tissue versus another, and the maternal ones are contributing to the neocortex, I think that is important in terms of the different selection pressures that are on these imprinted genes when we start to look at social mammals, and particularly social primates, because the different selection pressures are being exerted on the maternal alleles to the paternal alleles. And therefore, That's where I see a slight difference coming in. I'm not trying to suggest for 1 minute that genomic imprinting arose in order to give bigger brains to... that's not the case. It was already in place long before this was taken over with primates. And in any case, the outcome is because the mother passes on those imprinted alleles to both sons and daughters, sons will benefit from it just as much as daughters. It's just that the selection pressures are greater in the matriline than the patriline, but both sons and daughters benefit. It's not like females are getting bigger brains and males are being left behind. Both benefit. Right.
There does seem to be an implicit asymmetry, because whether it's in a son or a daughter, a maternally active gene that has built, say, a neocortex,
right,
or, so I would have thought, basic theory would predict, the benefit female relative rather more than male one, because it knows it's related to them.
Well, it's certainly in the context of primate social behavior, that is the case, because it's the females that are socially cohesive. It's the females that are affiliated. It's the females that maintain the social continuity. And if we're saying that in order to do that, you need a bigger brain helps it, then of course it is of advantage to the females.
Down in the front.
Yep.
Yep.
Not the chimpanzee is the one exception, and not true of humans. Well, I can comment on it, but it's speculation. I don't know what the answer for that is, but I would suggest that there comes a point where you have actually developed a brain beyond an optimal size, when it can actually be used for anything. It doesn't matter. Once you've gone beyond a certain size, the strategies are not exactly infinite, but they're very much broader. You're not constrained by the same sort of constraints that you were earlier in evolutionary time in the case of, say, the Cercopithecus monkeys. So, you know, and as I say, since the consequences of this are passed to sons as well as to daughters, there comes a point where males can capitalize on it just as much, if not more, than females. Please, yeah.
Would you like just to speak up and perhaps stand up so that everybody can hear? Thank you.
Right. Okay. Well, I'm sure there is even in the other chimps as well. I mean, I'm not saying that the females are not socially cohesive, but the point that I think you were making is that the social continuity seems to go more through the patriline in chimps. And indeed, I think that's true, Rob, isn't it, for a lot of human societies as well?
Yes, I mean,
it's
a negative, but I think in humans, if you look at the number of societies where females exchange, they're greater than the number where males are. But
yeah.
The idea is, therefore, that the male chimp.
Yes, please.
Right.
From my reading of the literature, I would
Okay.
So
okay.
Just because the good boys don't have very long brain spikes, so it was surprising. It was interesting. Can you comment on the way you think that decision making in an environmental context would be more emotional?
I think it would be both. I think it would be emotional because you're hungry, and it would be executive in, or at least, well, it just depends. I mean, if you're talking about spatial learning and wanting to know where trees are in your environment, you would still be thinking of limbic brain. You'd be thinking of hippocampus in spatial. I don't think cerebellum's much, but certainly hippocampus you would. Well, but move, but so the whole of cortex striatum is movement as well.
Yes, please.
Tristan Wyatt, Oxford. On a different tack, you mentioned in an earlier slide the importance of pheromones and the experimental.
Right.
And I was wondering what the trend in the importance of pheromones for communication and sexual communication as you go to the different groups.
Okay, well, by far the strongest evidence for pheromones influencing reproduction and behavior comes from rodents. And as you probably know there, pheromones will induce estrus in anestrous females, they will accelerate puberty in prepubertal females, and they'll block pregnancy in females that have recently been mated. And the neural and the endocrine mechanisms whereby that's brought about are from a subsection of the olfactory system known as the accessory olfactory system, the vomeronasal organ. This is a phylogenetically old organ, which is very common in reptiles. You see snakes going around with their tongues and putting their tongue, what they're doing is testing the chemicals around them, bringing them back and putting them into the vomeronasal organ. Well, that vomeronasal organ persists in most mammals, the exceptions being higher primates and us. Although, quite recently, some people in the States have found that this structure is present in humans. Now, I've no direct evidence for one way or the other, but I've spoken to ear, nose, and throat surgeons, and they say, no, it's not present. It's atavistic. You see a little bump there that may represent it. It's certainly present in humans during development. It's present embryologically, very clear and very strong, but in the only human embryos that I've looked at, there's no indication that they have an accessory olfactory bulb, which is to where this projects. So what is happening, I think, and it would make good sense to me, that once you move to higher executive decision-taking processes so far as reproduction is concerned, you don't want it to be under this stimulus response system of pheromones acting immediately and producing a response that is not under your control. Because this response you get in mice, it's acting, the projection is directly into the hypothalamus, directly into the limbic brain. It doesn't pass through any neocortical mechanism before it gets there. Likewise with reflex ovulation, that's directly into there. Likewise with seasonal breeding, photoperiodic cues, they're directly into that hypothalamus. So these are very important timing mechanisms, essential mechanisms, if you're not making decisions in any cognitive way. But once you shift to making them, you certainly don't need this, and you could do without it interfering. And the evidence would suggest that some of these structures that have done that in other mammals have become less obvious.
Yes, please. Yep, thank you.
There was a report came out of Edinburgh University, I think, a couple of years ago, supposedly spread over a number of years, in which if the ladies are conducted in considerable confidentiality, there was no kind of peer embarrassment, women consistently underestimated their IQ against objective measure. Males consistently overestimated their intelligence against objective measure. Now, it could be socially constructive, but could you imagine a situation in which there was an inbuilt, false sense of intellectual deficit in females that made them hunt for anything that looked like it would give, increased intelligence?
I can't think of any deterministic explanation for that. I would have thought that social factors are probably the most relevant factors there.
But when you've got them,
how did they control for that?
Well, it's very difficult. It's just a British Psychological Society presentation. The inference, the lady doing it seemed to think it was something quite deep. But I mean, I can say no more than that. But in the context of the general debate of the great encephalopathy, you can almost see that there was a functional bias, an intellectual inferiority complex, driving women remorselessly to the smart mate.
Possibly. But let me be clear. I'm not saying that there are one thing I'm categorically not saying is that what we're looking at here are sex differences in the brain. I'm saying that the consequence of imprinting is it's passed to both sons and daughters equally.
Yes, I think that, right? I can imagine grabbing any good gene that was out there because the first shortfall. And yes, sons and daughters, no problem at all.
Right. Yes, please. You're Lawrence Hurst, aren't you? Right. I think that was your idea, Lawrence, not Azim's. We wrote to you about this, and you wrote back and gave that put that hypothesis forward, and we're very, very grateful for that. But and I don't think Azim would claim it for 1 minute. I mean, I think we were looking. The point was, and I think it was a very good point that you made, that whatever brought about genomic imprinting, it occurred long before we're getting these differences in the brain. But they can then capitalize on this and make use of it. Now, what, as it were, brought this into being with respect to feeding and getting differential diet, that seems to me as if it's fitting very much into the conflict hypothesis that you were not terribly happier with when the last person spoke. I think that...
I'm happy
with it in the... I just think about genomic imprinting very much in terms of development and a collaboration between the genomes. And I think that, particularly in mammals, once fertilization becomes internal, and once anything that goes wrong with development is going to have repercussions not only for the offspring, but also for the mother as well, it's absolutely important to take the decision-taking processes in development correct. And I think that when you have a balance of the only one allele from each parent being expressed in this way, then first of all, because one is silenced for a period and then gets an opportunity for expression, it seems that it has that possibility to catch on if it's positive and be suppressed if it's not. And so I think that really what we're looking at in the genomic imprinting is more of a profound and important effect on development, not just brain development, but all sorts of tissue developments. And I think its importance in terms of what has been happening in evolution, because we know that a number of these genes that are imprinted are growth promoting, and others are what you call tumor suppressor genes. They're not really tumor suppressor at all. What they are is in development, they're stop genes to stop development at a certain time. Once you've got the basic mammalian plan worked out, you can improvise on that almost infinitum just by simply having these stop-start signals operating at different times. So you can grow longer limbs, longer necks, depending. Because the other thing about genomic imprinting is the imprint isn't necessarily in all tissues. There are certain tissues which are free from this imprint. So I think it's extremely difficult to come up with an all-embracing general theory of what imprinting is doing, especially as we know what more and more of the imprinted genes are. You can't fit them into any one category, other than that they are crucial to development.
Yes, please, in the middle.
Looking at this before,
I hadn't really thought about it, to be honest with you. It does seem to me, I mean, I like to try and get at what causal mechanisms can be for any of these things, if I possibly can, before I try and think too hard about it. And so I can't for the life of me understand what they might be in the context of the example you just gave. And I don't know how hard that is in terms, I mean, who published it and what was...
Nature.
Sorry?
Nature.
In Nature. And it said...
Not
on occasions. What? I can't understand that. Yeah. I can't understand it. Not in terms of what I've been saying, anyway.
Helena.
Helena Crowley, LSE. It's a bit underhand, but it's picking up on something you discussed last time. May I ask you again?
Sure.
You suggest that... nice way of putting it. You suggest that it's a matter of cooperation between the maternal and paternal parts of the genome. Could I just press you again on how you would recognize whether it is cooperation or whether it's conflict? I agree that it would be nice if they cooperated, but what makes you so sure that it is cooperation? What would be the signs of cooperation as opposed to the end of an arms race, or a stage of an arms race over reducing time?
Okay. Well, if you look at it in terms of an arms race, it does seem to me that whenever we try and put an imbalance, we increase the dosage of one of these alleles more than the other. The consequences are pretty dire. In fact, in most cases, they are lethal for a large number of these genes. So it does. If you've got this conflict going on all the time, it seems to me a very high-risk strategy that's happening. And so I can't be categorical one way or the other until I know very much more about all of the mechanisms and what they're doing. And that just happens to be what I favor. And I think that the idea of conflict, I think, is quite good. And I go along with that with respect to the placental development. Certainly, as David Haig brought it up at the time, when we knew about IGF and IGF-2 receptor. But of course now there are other imprinted genes coming in, like MASH-2, which is important for the development of, maternally expressed, important for the development of the syncytia trophoblast. And if anything goes wrong with that one, you get placental deformity. So you've got to expand it to incorporate the new information that's coming along as more and more of these genes are identified. What we do know about the imprinted genes that have been identified by now, they're not actually all growth factors, as was suggested. A number of them are SNRP, small nuclear ribonuclear proteins, which are concerned with alternative splicing. Others are transcription factors, which act on other genes downstream. In fact, all of them seem to be acting on other genes, whether they are acting as tumor suppressors to switch other genes off, or oncogenes, or alternative splicers, or transcription factors. They never, of all the ones that I know of so far, none of them seem to have a simple effect. They all seem to affect other parts of the genome in quite a major way. Please, yeah, I thought I'd say something that got you going there. Yeah.
Thank you.
One of the things that wasn't mentioned that imprinting does is that it creates a mutational hotspot. When the allele is methylated, you get cytosine to thymine translocations occurring very regularly. And it looks as if that, as it were, could be speeding up mutations. Right. Let me just ask you a question on that, if I may. Is that possible, Joe? What advantage do you think that imprinting has over normal Mendelian expression? I mean, in terms of spread in the population, I can't see that it's helping. I'm just curious to know what imprinting gains over normal Mendelian inheritance in terms of propagating. I mean, I can see that you're enhancing the rate of mutations, but how much better are those mutations put into the population through imprinting than through normal Mendelian genetics, through normal Mendelian expression and inheritance? But if that mutation had occurred on a non-imprinted allele, wouldn't it have been got selected just as well? Well, yeah, I know, but I'm just saying, if a mutation had occurred on a non-imprinted allele, would it not have got selected so well? I can't say very much about the behavior of the AG mice because they really just don't... I mean, the problem is that they are so big that you often have to deliver them by cesarean section, and it's very difficult to get them to survive that way. You have to get the timing right. They're also extremely labor-intensive to make. These have all been made by Sheila Barton, and she's one of the few people in the world that can make them. They're not easy to produce. And we've had one that has actually developed to be an adult. When we come to the PG, that's much better. PGs will develop until they become adult, and we've looked at the behavior. and we've looked at many aspects of behavior, and the only one that seems to differ is that males that have a higher contribution of the PG cells are more aggressive. Now, I don't know why that is, but that's what we found. It's also interesting that the PG, the human PG chimera that I think you spoke about, there, the only behavioral thing that they find with the human PG chimera is that child is also more aggressive. But I can't explain that at the moment. We're looking into what that might be. I've got some possible answers, but I'd rather keep them quiet until we know more or less what is happening.
I think perhaps that might be a good point at which to draw the proceedings to a close. There will be an opportunity to have further discussion and ask further questions of both the speakers over drinks in A85, which is the room where we normally have drinks. So if any of you don't know the way to go, please follow the flow. I've been asked to ask you to please go out in the reverse direction that you came in. In other words, please don't use these side exits. I gather that people do get lost if they try to get out that way. Can I also please draw your attention to the series of dates for your diaries? We have a continuing full program of seminars through to the summer. The final thing, which it's a great pleasure for me to do, is to continue a tradition which has grown up with the Darwin seminars, which is to make small presents, to give small presents to both of the speakers. And I wonder, Austin, if I could persuade you to come down to the front just for a moment. We're indebted on this occasion to the generosity of Michael Rogers, who is Bill Hamilton's publisher at W.H. Freeman. Had Bill been able to chair the seminar as we had originally hoped, then he would have been presenting signed copies of his new book to both the speakers. As he's not here, the best we're able to do for the moment is to present, as it were, intellectual or literary IOUs to both our speakers, with the assurance that there will be signed copies of the book following on very closely. And I'd like to take this final opportunity to thank both of our speakers again for a most stimulating pair of talks, which have, I think, amply lived up to the very high standards that our Darwin seminar speakers have given us throughout the series so far. Thank you very much. Thank you.